This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. In this episode, I speak with the Brazilian architect Carla Yasaba, who over the past two decades has made a name for herself with a slew of elegant residential projects. But it was really her design for the Humanidad Pavilion in Rio in 2012 that gained her international recognition. It was this giant temporary structure for a United Nations organized conference on sustainable development, which was reminiscent of Cedric Price and John Littlewood's Fun Palace, and consisted primarily of recycled scaffolding, suspending a series of meeting and exhibition spaces, all linked together by a public path. The project earned her the inaugural Arc Vision Prize for Women in Architecture, and since then her work has included a range of more personal and small-scale projects, including a proposal for Brazil's first cancer hospice in Rio, and an outdoor chapel structure she designed for the 2018 Vatican Pavilion and the Venice Architecture Biennale. I met with Carla in early May of 2022. We spoke over Zoom and talked about, among other things, the blurred boundaries in her work between art and architecture, and the ways in which theater and scenography have changed her understanding of architecture's symbolic potential. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. I wanted to start by talking about or understanding your relationship to art. I read that your grandmother was an artist. And I wondered if you could start by just talking about your relationship to her and her artwork, and as a child, your understanding of what it was that she did and how that maybe informed your own interest in a kind of artistic practice.
At first, it was fascinating to see a woman making things, you know, like really, it was really like an action, a woman working with, I 70 years old, 80, so I saw many ages, but that was for me already something fascinating to see this energy, you know, that you need to put to develop a work and of course she had a fantastic library, so I could get this fantastic library of architecture and art.
Do you remember what kind of books she had, or the ones that you were reading through?
She had all the collection of Domus from the 50s, 60s. She had all the, also, everything about modern art, beautiful books. And for that moment, it was already a lot to have this, and, you know, access to this in the north of Brazil, that you don't have even, at that time, a library to go to have this, but she had herself.
So she was kind of like a gateway for you into the world of art and architecture.
For sure, yes.
And I mean, you started more in the realm of installation design or exhibition design, is that right?
I as a student, I decided not to work with architecture. I was looking for something else, maybe stage design, and then I started to work for Gisela Magalhães. That was a woman, an architect in Brazil that worked with Vascânia Maia, and she was the first, I would say, exhibition designer in Brazil to do works in historical museums. So I worked for, as a student, for 3 years with her, and I thought I would continue to work only in this area of or stage design or exhibition design. Also, as a student, I did a workshop with Jean-Guy Lecat, the scenographer of Peter Brook, in Rio, but it was open more for students of theater. But I was there, I think, the only architect doing this workshop. I think Jean Guillet-Cat still does this workshops around the world. Then with this workshop, I think I began to see our discipline through another discipline, through the work of Peter Brook, and how he changes. He doesn't never accept the theaters as it is. So he changes the architecture. He built for many years a theater over theaters, you know, traditional theaters. He built another theater over.
So I feel like I need to understand what that means a little more. Theater over theater.
Yes, theater over theater. Maybe that's not the best way to explain, but he really did entirely change the architecture of the theater. Putting the stage in another place, changing the relationship of people with this stage, returning to the Elizabethan theater in a way, where people are really close to the involved inside the scenario. Mm-hmm. So he did that in older theaters. He did that in Zurich. They did occupied places of the city, unexpected. So it is a group that begin to do this. But yeah. Everything they want is another relationship with the public. So for that, they changed the architecture. So and then the scenography he did inside, after all these changes, the scenography he did inside was enough to, with really almost nothing. Because what is necessary for him was architecture. So that's why I was very... fascinated by, first, how critic he was with architects.
Really?
He never accepted the theaters as they are. And after that, understanding his gestures with scenography, that was enough to communicate what he wanted. So it is a mix of scenography and the theatrical spaces together that is only one thing. It's not a stage separated, you know. It's everything is only one thing. And then there's a book, An Open Circle, of Jean Guillet-Cat, his scenographer, that is, you have all these interventions in all these theaters of Europe and Latin America, United States.
So I'm interested in trying to understand where this, what sounds like early interest in stage design and scenography, first manifest. It sounds like this is what you were studying before architecture, and this is what you were drawn to as a kind of nascent designer yourself. And it sounds like even before you were aware of figures like Peter Brook, who, for listeners who aren't familiar, is a celebrated theater director, I think originally from the UK, but is now living in France, or his scenographer, Delacarte. Before you were aware of these figures, it sounds like there was some kind of attraction to scenography and to the world of theater. And can you tell me more where that attraction came from? Is it possible to start to articulate on a fundamental level why the world of theater was so compelling to you?
For this idea of impermanence that you have, and that things end, you know, it's not even possible to record, because theater you cannot record, you know. So it is very fascinating to see things just dissipating, you know, just that, and then that's it. You cannot see again. You cannot. And also, when I begin with Gisela Magalhães in the stage, exhibition designs, I was already fascinated by this temporary effect also on people and how things get in their mind forever. It's temporary, but it's part of our imaginary world now, even if ends now, the pavilion of Humanidade, I think in Rio, is it's really part of everyone's not memory only, but of the imaginary in this place, in this experience. It is an experience. No?
That's exactly where I wanted to go. I mean, it seems like such a logical project to talk about in relation to this idea of transience that you're describing in theater. And so for listeners who aren't familiar, the Pavilion Humanidad was a temporary pavilion for the United Nations Conference on Sustainability that was held in Rio in 2012. And this was a project that for you really brought your work to an international audience. It was a spectacular vision of a project, this temporary, massive scaffold structure that only lasted for, 2 weeks?
It was only 2 weeks, yes. Because it was only the time of the event.
And yet, as you say, it has this kind of indelible mark on the imagination. It's a project that does live on as a kind of fantasy, much in the same way that a project that's been likened to Cedric Price and Joan Littlewood's Fun Palace. Mm-hmm. Again, the Fun Palace didn't even exist to begin with, and yet it has a kind of permanence in the architect's imagination. And again, has a strong relationship to theater. I mean, Joan Littlewood, as many listeners will know, mm-hmm. was herself a theater director and instrumental in conceiving of the Fun Palace itself. Mm-hmm. But can we talk a little more about the Pavilion Humanidad, how it was conceived, mm-hmm. and in collaboration with who exactly? I know mm-hmm. there was a theater director involved in the conception of the pavilion.
Curiously, yes, as well as the Fun Palace, no, had this collaboration with theater director. Her name is Bielesa. She's a theater director, but she does a lot of exhibition designs too. So she was invited at that time to do an exhibition design about sustainability for the United Nations events, and she said, "I'm not going to do it inside a plastic tent with air conditioning in Copacabana." So she thought that the building should be a reflection about the subject, and she didn't accept this, so she looked for an architect to it was not a competition, it was at the end an invitation to think about this. And then we visited and we found the scaffolding covered with plastic, and then we just continued what the scaffolding base that was there with 5 meters high until 25 meters high. There was this temporary pre-existence there, that was profited, you know, for.
And when you say you found it, this is because in Copacabana, there are always events going on, right? And there are always these temporary stage sets with these plastic canopies. So it sounds like what you're saying is you've almost taken this found object and then kind of extended its logic to its extreme and remove the plastic covering, so what you're left with is a giant open framework. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, tell me more about the collaboration with Bielesa, the theater director. What kind of conversations were you having? What was her influence on the final outcome?
It was a bit like as if she was inviting a stage designer for her theater, but it was architecture. So it was a collaboration in the sense of we didn't knew the program yet, but we had an idea that everything could happen. There was only one precise idea that it was made of parallel walls with 170 meters with 25 meters high. And between those parallel walls, there was a public path, a path for the event, so technical path, but all these paths lead to the same point. It was the roof, so it was very clear that those paths would organize the entire building. The name of the building is Humanity Pavilion. So the center of the building is a library with all the important books mentioned by many people important in Brazil. Each one chose 100 books, so it was like a center of the building, the center of the humanity. So This was her idea. This is all her idea as a program, no? So she, as a scenographer, as a theater director. So I was there as an architect to, at the end, give form to this, but with this central idea of architecture that was proposed.
And elsewhere, you've described the project as a kind of ready-made. And this description applies to a more recent project that, in a way, is the second iteration of it, which is the Ministry for All, which was exhibited at the Storefront for Art and Architecture in 2019. And imagine this kind of lattice work of scaffolding in Brasilia, which also you described as a kind of ready-made. And I'm really interested in your use of that term. It's an art term, art historical term, which was invented by, or conceived first by Duchamp. And it just brings, I think, a reading of the architecture into line with art and art history in a way that I wondered if you could talk more about. Why for you is it important to understand these temporary structures as ready-mades?
So the ready-made of Duchamp and the principle of ready-made is to find something accidentally, profit of this, transform something else, and where the idea of beauty is not there as a principle, but at the end the wheel is beautiful. There are a lot of incredible objects, but he says it's indifferent to beauty. So I think it's he affirms that, but I at the end it's not that true, because there's a beauty, you know, in the objects. Mm-hmm. So I think when I refer to this is in the, especially the Ministry for All, is when I find a situation in Brazil that is the parliaments, and they have all the same measure, the same height, and I had a lot of difficulties to think about any project in this scale of Brasilia. It's everything is a scale that is hard to reach. And then also I didn't want to affect the drawing, you know, of Lúcio Costa, Oscar Niemeyer, and to be invisible. The proposal was to build an imaginary building with the same measure, the same height, the same distance between the ministry, except that this one would be made of scaffolding, and it would be a ministry for everyone, a place of discussion that we can do an analogy with an agora or something that, you know, people need to have. I can imagine this building. It's not a project. It's an idea of project, but where a stage exists and agglomerates lots of people, and they can enter and go out freely, and would be like a monument to democracy. In a way, in a moment that democracy is not really happening. So it is kind of a political also attitude towards this strange, fake democracy that we are living. And then I think also the ready-made returning to Duchamp, they are not only an object that change meanings. There is always something that wants to communicate besides the object, besides that is a meaning, no? So that's all the political meaning behind this is there. And so I think the powerful of the ready-mades is how meaningful they are. So I think this is the relation I could do. But anyway, I think there is a beauty there. Anyway, well, not
absolutely
being invisible, or it's not invisible, it's a building. So
it's true that there's something so satisfying about understanding the working parts of things, understanding the machinery behind a certain phenomenon or feeling or event. And I think with the scaffolding projects, both the Humanidad Pavilion in Rio and then this Unrealized project in Brasilia, there is this attraction to laying in a way, reality bare. Peeling back the layer, the kind of veneer of the facade, quite literally, and understanding how exactly these things are held up and how exactly events occur within them. And that same attitude was applied to the exhibition of the Ministry of All, or the Ministry for All, which was shown at the Storefront for Art and Architecture in 2019, where in addition to exhibiting the project, you also started to peel back the layers of this iconic facade of the storefront itself. Many listeners will know it's this facade that has many kind of, has these strange cutouts, which are on pivots, so they can kind of hinge open and shut and expose the gallery to the street. And what you did is you unscrewed the kind of metal finishing and then hung these metal pieces inside the gallery and left the facade exposed to its really haphazard structure, so that the image of the gallery frontage now is of this kind of slipshod construction, which the metal facade was concealing previously. And for me, there's a real delight, again, in understanding the inner workings, understanding what goes on behind this veneer, behind essentially this mask of a project, to get at something that feels somehow more real or more authentic. And I wonder if it's a similar experience that we have when we watch a play or a performance by Peter Brook. And it's just reminding me about when you're talking earlier about the kind of stages that were constructed, stages beyond the standard environment of the theater, stages that are somehow within real environments or real contexts. If maybe there's a similar sensation of being closer somehow to reality in those kinds of performances.
Mm-hmm. First, I will talk about the concrete panels of the facade in New York. That is this iconic facade, iconic for them, not very.
Oh, this is concrete. I thought they were metal.
It is like a pre-molded thin plaques of concrete and mix it.
Thin, okay.
And the first idea to dismantle I want to dismantle more than I did, but Jose Esparza, the director, didn't want me to, to destroy the entire gallery, but it was, there was a moment that was enough, otherwise it would not exist anymore. And anyways, it is. I was looking also at this moment for an action. This is an action to remove something and build with that, and you don't need anything else besides what is there. And then discover a bit more about this iconic gallery. And what we found was this terrible construction at the same time so beautiful, because we can imagine when it was built how improvised it was. No one knows about it. This was totally improvised, and it's so nice, it's so incredible to find, to discover this and this imperfection. And then but at the first moment I was looking for this action that is done there with the material that is there, and unfold something and discover and build with that. So as the association we could do with the Ministry of All, for All is this first touching this iconic images of the city and transforming with almost nothing, you know, and building with almost nothing. And and then Marcelo Cidade, the artist that did, he took these pieces of the facade and did an installation inside the facade. Inside was floating. It's a clear reference to Helio Chessica's work in Brazilian artist, but it's a literal reference, but so beautiful at the same time, because he makes what was outside floating inside, and it's a reference, but it's something else too.
So yeah, I guess the hinge now of the question brings us back to the realm of theater and that sensation of a different encounter with reality, where the inner workings of a given situation are exposed, whereas traditionally they would have been concealed. So basically, I just want to learn more about Peter Brook's work, and I want to understand if we can go deeper into your attraction to his work and what exactly about it has drawn you as an architect to developing a PhD project around it.
First, was the fascination about how he modifies the theater space. This was one thing. Why he was not satisfied with theater spaces. And this was the first fascination. The second one is how he needs, for example, only sand in the floor and two pieces of bamboo, that with two pieces of bamboo he communicates thousands of meaning. He does with two pieces he built his entire theater. No, it's a cross, it's a forest, it's a boat with only two pieces of bamboo. And I think this was really fascinating, how he could find transform every second of his theater, the meaning of things with nothing. And so it's with theater with not so many gestures, but the communications of meanings were intense. And I think when I was a student and I saw that, I wanted to do architecture. He does his theater, you know, like with gestures that, you know, it's each gesture in his theater, really gesture or physical or with elements, communicating something. So I understand architecture as a gesture too, all the time.
This does bring us directly on to your project in Venice as part of the Vatican's first entry into the Venice Architecture Biennale in 2018, which is, in a way, a kind of elemental sculpture. And I know that you've had this debate in the past where people tend to understand your work more along the lines of installation art or artwork or sculpture, and you push back. So I wondered if you could, first of all, describe the chapel for the Vatican you designed in Venice in 2018, and touch on that tension or discrepancy between a minimalist kind of sculptural project and a bona fide work of architecture.
Yes, it is an open air chapel. So first, there's no roof, no walls, and goes very directly to the essentiality of the program. You go to the chapel to sit at the bench, never comfortable, and look at the cross. So that is the suffering. So it is the essence of what you do in a chapel. Then I think the symbols are clearly there, you know, the cross, the laid cross, and then the seven elements of concrete in the floor that elevates with 12 centimeters. Everything has 12 centimeters by 12 centimeters. The steel is 8 meters each steel beam. And I think those elements of 1 meter with the seven elements in the floor, they are really important for giving a kind of a measure to this emptiness, because it's too empty and we need this measure, you know, so that's the only explanation I can find for using seven, because I don't need to use seven, I could use two, three. Why seven? And then this rhythm, I think we need to see and to be kind of gives like a scale for us that we need. So
that really helps me understand actually this framing of a piece of work like that as architecture. I think if someone saw it on its own, I mean, I'm going to try and describe it now. It's this, is it chrome plated or a polished metal? What is the material?
Polish, Stainless steel.
Polished stainless steel cross, upside down,
mm-hmm.
which then folds into another cross, which is laying on a bed of concrete foundations. And the cross, horizontally on these foundations, acts as a bench, as you described it, so that the visitor, the user, is sitting on this fallen cross and looking up at an inverted cross. And as you've described it, it's in this act of prayer or worship, the same kind of act and the same kind of, I guess, situation in terms of the discomfort of the act of prayer that would take place within a chapel itself. So in a way, the program is the same, but the space or the form within which it takes place is its most minimal or most reduced version. It's like if you removed any more, you'd have nothing left. And I think this is where I start to understand this idea of nothingness that you've mentioned before in relation to the work of Peter Brook. It starts to kind of come into a clearer view for me, where for you, the architecture is as minimal as possible. You're doing, in a way, as little as possible to support as much as possible. And it's the same with the Pavilion Humanidad. It's the least structure required, I guess, to facilitate this really robust social program. So we're kind of teetering on the abyss. We're teetering on nothingness. We're very close to nothingness in these kinds of works that you've done. Mm-hmm. I'm just conscious as I'm trying to grasp at this and describe it, it's quite abstract. And in a way, it's very wholly in the realm still of the conceptual, but in a way that I enjoy and cherish and admire. But I'm also conscious that it's still the kind of conversation you'd imagine being had in the context of conceptual art. I'm just thinking about this publication by the Cork Street Gallery that came out last year, which was guest edited by the curator, Hans Ulrich Obrist, where he gathered 30 artists and posed his favorite question to them, which is, what is an unrealized project of yours you could tell me about? And he chose you. You're an architect, obviously, but you're in the company of other artists talking about your work in the context of artistic practice. And this kind of conversation that we're having, I think it belongs in a way, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but to me it belongs more in that realm, the realm of conceptual art or of contemporary art. And so what I'm wondering is, for you, how do you see your work developing in this context? Is this something you're comfortable with? Or are you resistant to this interpretation? Do you want somehow for the work itself to become closer to reality again? I mean, are there housing schemes in the future you'd imagine yourself pursuing? Are there more mundane, kind of everyday, literally real kind of architectural programs that you'd go after as a designer? Or are you more happy to remain in the conceptual world?
This limit of art and architecture for me is blurred. I don't fit in here or there. So I don't. I think obviously, I been fascinated by Marcel Duchamp, but also by the American minimalism. But I think all this is very distant from minimalism because this is, as the theater of Peter Brook, full of symbols. So it means that the minimalism is completely out of, it's fantastic. I'm fascinated by the American minimalism in art. But it's absolutely an absence of meaning, of symbols. No, not meaning, but symbols. And I think the theater of Peter Brook is done with not absolutely, almost no elements, but it's full of symbolism. So symbols and significance. That's so. And then returning to your question of this boundary between art and architecture. And yes, I do look for programs that are architectural programs. For example, the Ministry for All is a program, in fact, a program. Also, the other question that Hans Ulrich asked me, what would you do between the 710 pavilion of Oscar Niemeyer and the landscape design of Boulemax, Aterro do Flamengo, this park, immense park. So the question of Hans Ulrich, when he was going to rebuild the pavilion of Oscar Niemeyer in Aterro do Flamengo in Rio de Janeiro to commemorate the 20 years of the 710 gallery. The question was, what would you do between Boulemax and Oscar Niemeyer? And then again, I returned to a program, a broad architectural program. I could not go, I could do something more, but I never do. I always return. Also, we could build the dream of Boulemax, that is a nursery plant. And then in this nursery plant, there is a public space to see the drawings of Boulemax that are always on the floor and no one sees from the top, only this this expensive buildings that surrounds, they see this, all these drawings of the landscape. So it would be a building for the public also to see this.
I mean, it's interesting that Obrist, as a kind of prompt to you, asked you to enter a conversation with two celebrated Brazilian architects, Oscar Niemeyer and Boulemax, who I guess was a landscape architect. But I just wanted to ask one more question in that context before I let you go, and that is, to what extent is your nationality and your national identity as a Brazilian informing the kind of work you do now? How important is it to you to understand yourself or position yourself as a Brazilian architect, given the fact that you're now living and working in London and you're teaching in Switzerland? In a way, you're a very international practitioner. So, yeah, what is your relationship to your national identity in that context?
My national identity is part of my education and my contemplation also of this environment that is Rio, that is Brazil, and it is present. It is. I'm just floating everywhere, and I'm living in London, but I'm going to live in Belgium, and I don't know. I continue to work for Brazil. I continue to be a Brazilian architect, and this is. Fortunately, I can have work there now. I could not. I mean, could be in another place, but it's there, and I think it's so important to continue to be there. I don't have to leave there to work, but so. I think also this, it's been very rich for me, this exchange of in the Swiss University and my PhD in Madrid. All this is enriching environment for me to continue to reflect about what to do and what I should do, continue to do work in. All this has been very, very a place of research for me, all this. No? So that means it affects and will affect the work immediately. No? And to be far from Brazil is, and look have a distance. No? I'm continue to be Brazilian, but I need this distance for many reasons. It's good for cultural reasons, but it's good in this political moment that is in crisis, in economical crisis, and I don't want to be there. So this has been very important, and it will last for I don't know how long, but for a little long.
Carla, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Matthew.
Really appreciate it.
Me too. It was lovely.
Scaffold is an Architecture Foundation production. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I produce the show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word, and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Carla Yasaba, thanks as always to Scandalin, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.